Well, United States Air Force's mysterious X-37B space plane will apparently return back to planet Earth this week, possibly as early as tomorrow, after 22 months in orbit on a secret mission. What's it been up to? Up next, Robert Morningstar joins us. We're going to be talking about the secret space program and take a look at also some of the other images he has sent us, plus a little take on JFK next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast. What a way to get Monday off and rolling, huh? Robert Morningstar with us, civilian intelligence analyst, psychotherapist in New York City, received a degree in psychology from Fordham. He's an expert in Chinese language, history, martial arts. He's an FAA-licensed pilot, instrument ground instructor. Robert has studied the paranormal and UFOs for more than 40 years. He's currently the associate editor of UFO Digest, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Robert, always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me back. I couldn't be happier.
Oh, this is you have
in the next hour.
Oh my gosh, you've got so much going on. It's amazing. Plus, thank you for the pictures that you sent our way that we've posted already at coasttocoastam.com.
Yeah, I saw that. Thank you very much. It's great to get the word out. And I have to tell you, every time I'm on Coast to Coast, a stroke of good luck comes streaming in the aftermath. And the last time I was with you was about the Martian junkyard. The junkyard on
yes.
Mars.
Great story.
Beach on Mars that was released in a video on the NASA channel. And in the aftermath of that, I was hit with just a confluence of events and discoveries, some of which are on your page tonight, that deal with the secret findings that were hidden of the Apollo missions to the moon, and I called them the revelations of Apollo when I presented at the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization Conference that was held in San Mateo last June.
How were they received?
It was very well received, and I was honored to be on the same stage with a great group of speakers and lecturers, among them Richard Dolan, Mark McCandless, Catherine Austin Fitz.
That's great people.
And many more. John Rappaport, Joseph Farrell.
Sounds like a who's who of Coast to Coast, Robert.
I'm glad to hear that. It's good to be among friends. And I have to say it was one of the best conferences that I've ever experienced, either as a speaker and as a viewer. So much has come out of that, and it was a springboard for and many more discoveries.
Super, super. Let's begin. Well, let me ask you about the secret space program because of the story that's breaking, and that is the secret space plane is coming back tomorrow, apparently. Well, what do you think's been going on there?
Well, from my sources, it's that we're engaged in a secret space war. It's kind of a turf war to keep certain undesirables away from our space, our inner space, but this game of tag has been going on for a long time. This is the second time that secret space plane has disappeared and come back. Remember the first time?
Yeah, that's right.
They said, oh, we lost it. Oh, we don't know what happened to it. And then, many months later, made a perfect landing. I think it was at Vandenberg Air Force Base. I'm not sure. But it is a really interesting craft. It looks like a baby space shuttle. And it can really loiter. It can hang out up there for a very long period of time. Of course, a craft like that is capable of a multi-mission tasking, from spying, overflying countries, or even delivering things.
Mm-hmm. Or all of the above.
Or it's capable of going to the moon and around and coming back. We just don't know where they send it. The thing is painted totally black on the bottom part. If I recall correctly, it was a very dark-looking craft.
Yeah, so, it's whitish on the top. But
right, the old space shuttle.
But when you look at it from the bottom, it's all black.
Yeah. I have to say, it brings to mind the Black Triangle. And the videos that have been coming out about black triangles, the best of which I saw presented in California by Richard Dolan, who wrote UFO UFOs and the National Security State, and several other books, Volume 2 and UFOs for the 21st Century. He presented a video that left me staggered. It was a video that was apparently taken in Paris on an overcast night, and you know the Paris is very luminous, so the lights of the city were illuminating the cloud tops, and some fellow was taking a picture, panoramic landscape picture of Paris, and all of a sudden, over the top of this videographer, this giant black triangle overflies him like the opening scene in Star Wars.
Yeah.
When the Star Destroyer first comes over the top of your head and you see it chasing the module. So it appears. Now, here's the important thing. I've been tracking this black triangle UFO for years and years and years. It goes back to the 1940s. It goes, I found it on the moon. I found it in lunar orbiter photographs and Apollo photographs taken on the far side of the moon. And it's always got three point lights at the corner, white point lights, and a white light in the center. And this video that Richard Dolan presented showed this craft overfly the videographer, go beyond him, and it appears in full screen, dominating the skyline. Then it stopped. Then it tilted. Then it turned.
Amazing.
Itself. But here's the most amazing thing. At a certain point, the central light under the craft began to glow and grow bigger and bigger in a hemispherical form. And it started to expand and approach the whole length and width of the triangular craft. All of a sudden, we saw the hemisphere appear on the top and the bottom. And I realized that this light was growing on the top and bottom of the craft and growing into a bigger and bigger and bigger sphere of white light. When the sphere grew to encompass all three corners of the spacecraft, the whole craft turned into a ball of white light, a sphere of white light, and zip, gone in an instant, in the blink of an eye. And I was truly impressed by that, because now I know how the thing works. This, the luminosity expands from the center toward the three corner points. All of a sudden, the entire thing turns into a globe of light, and it's gone.
How big is it, Robert?
It looked like it was hundreds of feet. In
A couple football fields?
I would say so. It was very big. Maybe 1 foot. I mean, it's hard to tell, but it was gigantic. I would say several hundred feet. I would say 1 football field. It looked to me like 200 to 300 feet on an edge. Of course, there was no reference object in the sky, just the perspective and the distance to what I thought was the Eiffel Tower in the far, far background. But it was really the single most impressive video that I have ever seen of the black triangles. I've seen them, you know, in flight, hovering. As a matter of fact, my brother who lives in Kingston, New York, is always traveling the I-84 corridor. And about 10 years ago, he pulled off the road because he saw this giant triangle just floating serenely about 500 feet just off the highway. He pulled off and he's gawking at it, flabbergasted. And some guy pulls up and he's very nervous in behind. He goes, "What did he think? What is that?" He's my brother. You know, he's very straightforward. He's like, "What the F do you think it is?" Don't you look. And then my brother said to me, "Robert, you can't believe what this thing was like." And he said to me, "If you can imagine a U.S. Navy destroyer floating in the air 500 feet above a highway, then you'll have an idea of how big this thing was and how incredible."
Here's the question, though, Robert. Is it ours, or is it reversed engineered from ETs, or is it an ET?
It could be either. I believe that the black triangle that appeared in 1984 over the Indian Point nuclear reactor, which is a very famous, It happened twice. It came by once, and then it came by another day, and there was panic in the Indian Point reactor security corps, many of whom were former state troopers. And the thing was so big that all the security cameras in Indian Point captured it, but no one camera could capture the whole thing. And the length of the thing was 800 to 900 feet on a side. And I believe that that one was extraterrestrial. And the reason I say so is that Indian Point has been monitored by UFOs since the very beginning of its constructions. There's a famous picture on the internet called the Lake Tiorati UFO, T-I-O-R-A-T-I. Lake Tiorati is one of the seven lakes on the Seven Lakes Drive near Bear Mountain. And I go there all the time. I always swim in Lake Tiorati. A few years ago, I found a photograph that was called, there were two of them, Lake Tiorati UFO. It's taken from the shore through the trees. You see the trees in the foreground. You see the lake and you see the forest in the background. And a UFO has just come out of the lake. It's an amazing...
popped right out.
It's just, the photographer said he saw it come out of the lake and he caught it as it was rising. Now, a few years ago, I went, 3 years ago, I went, and there are various ways to get to Bear Mountain and to get to the summit or to get to the base. And I took a wrong turn. And I started thinking, you know, the right turn's going to come here anytime. I'll just wait for the right. And I was going, and I went about 2 miles, and I realized I was in the wrong place. But all of a sudden, I realized, oh, man, Lake Tiorati is over that ridge. And then I looked to my left, and there was Indian Point. And then I realized, my God, that UFO that was taken in the 1960s was in this lake all the time that they were building Indian Point. And it would pop up, and this is in Rockland County, or northern Rockland County, and the UFO would just come out, and they were observing the construction of Indian Point nuclear reactor, the energy plant there. And my own cousin, who lived in Pearl River, New York, in those days in the 60s, people don't know that Rockland County was the center of a missile defense batteries that used to defend New York against bombers, you know, Russian.
Yeah.
They were Nike bases, and I know soldiers master sergeants who were in charge of these missile bases, Nike missile bases. So my cousin lived in Pearl River, not far from there, and one night he saw a UFO, and it shot a green light into his room, and the green light hit him, and he couldn't move. And when the green light disappeared, he could move again.
It didn't take him, though, did it?
Well, this cousin and my younger brother both had close encounters at very young ages. As a matter of fact, this cousin of mine was saved by his grandmother from an abduction. He went on a long trip with the grandmother, and she was his caretaker, and he just wandered off. And all of a sudden, my great aunt, his grandmother, said that she had an overwhelming feeling that something was wrong, and where was Mark? And she started screaming, "Mark, Mark!" In the meantime, this little boy, he was about 5 or 6 years old at the time, he just wandered off up a hill following some very brilliant balloons. He thought they were balloons, and they were luminescent and lighting with beautiful colors, and there he thought he heard music, and it seemed to him that they was calling him. So he followed up the hill, and Grandma, with that grand maternal instinct, was overwrought, and she knew she had to find him, and she started screaming his name and running up the hill. When she got up the hill, she saw this little creature taking him by the hand, and she fought him off.
Huh.
And I'm taking my grandson, and it was a little gray guy who had enticed, and he was totally happy. My cousin was totally happy and thrilled, and, you know, thinking about, you know, Christmas lights and bubble gum and really wonderful childhood thoughts like that, totally innocent. But the grandmother, you know, got into a shoving match, and just knocked the thing off of him and carried him away.
She wanted no part of this thing, huh?
Yeah, but my brother was not so lucky. My brother was abducted in 1962 at the age of 7. And that's how long I've been studying alien abduction, because I was the first one to basically interrogate him. He went off to a place called Friendly Town in the Catskill region of New York to spend a month in the summer. You know, like the New York Times Fresh Air Fund?
Yep.
That kind of thing, city kid in the country. He was extremely happy to go. He was going to be riding horses, be on a farm, you know, see cows, etc. And he was thrilled to go. Within a week, he became totally distraught, didn't want to be there, cried for mom and dad, wanted to go home, would not stay, and we went, picked him up, brought him back. And he was very sullen and reticent and taciturn, all those words that mean you don't want to talk to anybody and feeling really bad. And the contrast was so great that I said to him, I took him aside, I said, Rudy, you know, what happened? You were so happy to go. You were going to be riding horses and be in the country. And he said, Robert, I got scared. I said, scared of what? He said, something strange happened. I said, what? He said, well, the first night I was there, the farmer made me sleep in his son's room, and it was on the ground floor, and there was a door that opened up into this back, this garden in the back of their house. There was one window with a shade, and it was low. There were flowers in front. And as I went to bed one night, I heard these little voices, and I was thinking, gee, that's strange. Sounds like munchkin voices, really high-pitched little voices. I couldn't make out what they were saying. So I got up out of bed and walked over to the window, and I raised the shade, and I didn't see anything. So I went back to bed, and then I heard the voices again. And now this time, I'm really wide awake, and I know I'm hearing it. So instead of walking to the window, I snuck over to the window really quietly and pulled up the shade really fast. And he said, then I saw these three little guys with their heads in the flower bed. They were no taller than the flowers. The flowers came up to the edge of the window. It was a low window.
Yeah.
And he says, and they hid in the flowers, and they had big black eyes, and they looked at me, and they said, you don't see us. We're not here. We're only flowers. You don't see us. We're not here. We are only flowers. And they said it three times, and he got a sense of dread. And he said they talked like munchkins, and they were really little. And this is a seven-year-old boy who has no knowledge of extraterrestrials.
Right.
Has no knowledge of UFOs. He didn't see a flying saucer hanging out the window. And so in his child's mind, he said, they're like munchkins, you know? And so he came back, but he became very distraught. He wet his bed. He had bad dreams. He couldn't stand anybody to touch him. And it took a very long time, as a matter of fact, 30 years, when I visited California in the early 90s. We hadn't seen each other for many, many years. And he brought out William Cooper's first manuscript called The Secret Government before he published Behold the Pale Horse. And he said, you got to read this. One of my security guards where I work gave this to me, and you've got to read it. So we started talking about UFOs, cattle mutilations, alien abductions, and then we got back to that point. And I began a series of probing questions to my brother that resulted in him remembering much more than what he had remembered as a seven-year-old boy. And it was this. They had come into the room. They had taken him away. They had laid him down on a table and tried to hold him down. And my brother, like a little lion. My father was a very tough, macho.
Hold on, Robert. Let's let you finish that up, and then I want to get into your work on the JFK assassination, because you dissected the Zapruder film. We'll be back. And have you watched yet our television program, Beyond Belief? I invite you all to go sign up and watch it, and watch all the other videos, too, as many as you want, for 10 days, absolutely free. Simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. You'll see all kinds of programs that you will find simply fascinating. And welcome back, Robert Morningstar with us. Robert, I'll let you finish that story, and we'll talk about your work on the JFK assassination. But you're talking about, sounded like an abduction case. What was it?
Yes. This an abduction case. The first abduction case that I became aware of was in 1962. It was my youngest brother. And when he came back from what was called Friendly Town, he was distraught. And 30 years later, when I raised the issue again and refreshed his memory and did what is called Rogerian therapy, it's a kind of a dialogue thing where you just ask natural questions and let the person elucidate. Well, he was able to remember that they carried him off. They put him down on a table, and he struggled. He fought. He kicked everything. He screamed, and they were demanding that they look. He look into their eyes, and he closed his eyes, and his willpower was so great that they tried everything to make him open his eyes, and he fought them off with his eyes closed for what he felt was hours, and then they put him back. And after that, he was very traumatized. He had a hair-trigger temper. He didn't want to be touched. He told me that at the time he felt dirty. And this contact, this is something very unpleasant about contact with these gray aliens. And one of the things that drives people really crazy is the terrible smell of them, because these creatures, they ingest and they excrete through their skin. So we can stop there and we can talk about Dulce or those kinds of things another time, but I really would like to bring up the news about the JFK assassination.
Yeah, tell me about your work with that, Robert.
Okay.
And of course, we're coming up on another anniversary next month.
It's very significant in particular from what I'm going to tell you. The first time that I was invited to be on your show was last November 22nd, 2013, on the 50th
anniversary. That's right.
And I had been on radio shows for a long duration leading up to that. And your call came as a surprise. I had done a show at 7 o'clock with Scott Peters on Far Out Radio. And I thought, wow, okay, it's over. And you called, and of course, what can I say? yes. And so I had to decide whether, since you had me on at 4 o'clock, I had to decide whether I was going to get some sleep, get some rest, get up, and then start again, or keep a vigil and go through the night.
And so just keep going,
I went to keep going and drink a lot of coffee and brush up on all the facts, you know? So the vigil was this. I was keeping time with the arrival of the body of the first casket at 6:35 at Bethesda, the arrival of the second casket at 6:45, the autopsy, the pre-autopsy, and then all that, the terrible things that were done to hoodwink the nation with the swapping of Tippett's brain, et cetera. This is another part of the story. But as I was trying to brush up on my facts, this algorithm that Google uses, that everyone's afraid of, it tracks everything you see, every site you visit, everything you buy, every email, and everybody's afraid of that. I'm not afraid of it because I've got nothing to hide. I don't care if people know that I go to this site or that site, or XYZ site, you know? It's just life, and I don't really care. Who knows? I'm a free American, and that's the way it is. So Google has this algorithm, and I have come to say, especially because of what I'm going to tell you, God works through Google in my life. It dropped an icon on my desktop that was related to the Zapruder film, which I've seen maybe 10,000 times. And I said, well, look at that. That one looks, you know, grainy, yellowed. Let me take a look at that. And I ran it, and instantly, within the first few feet of the film, I realized, hey, this is a bit different. And then I see it keep going, and when it got to the grassy knoll, I yelled. I screamed, oh, my God. I knew that I was seeing the real thing, that I had found the Zapruder film with the missing frames intact, the frames that were taken out of the current versions of the Zapruder film. It is very heavily doctored, and that's why I say I dissected the Zapruder film in 1992, and I addressed conferences in Providence and in Chicago, twice in Chicago. Was a part of a big panel in Dallas in 96. I was down in Dallas in 94, 96, and 98, and I met in 98 the man who was the closest person, the closest witness to the assassination of President Kennedy, who was not in the car, was Mr. William Newman and his wife.
Spectators.
Spectators. They loved the president. They were there with their child, holding them in, a child in their arms as the president went by. And Mr. Newman told me that President Kennedy was hit by two shots, and when the second shot tore his ear right off. Now, I thought he was wrong about that. I thought that he had mistaken the shot that took out the back of his head, and his looking at the ear, he saw a piece of bone about the same size fly off, and I thought that that was what he was talking about. So I explained that to him, and it made sense to him. However, on that night, November 22nd, 2013, on the 50th anniversary, as I waited to be on your show, I came across this, and I realized, oh, my God, this is word for word what Mr. Newman saw. And that is when I realized I have found the holy grail of the John F. Kennedy assassination. And I have sat with it for a year. I didn't look at it for a long time. I showed it very, very carefully to special people just to see what the effect would be. And the same shock that I went through, what went through this person, this friend of mine to whom I showed it, and I realized, my God, this is dynamite. Because instantly, there are two shocks that will hit you. The first shock is the shock of what really happened, which is gruesome.
And you mean more gruesome than what we've seen so far?
Indeed, it is sanitized. He was cut to shreds by more than two bullets. And it is sanitized, cleaned up.
All headshots too, Robert?
Yes.
Yeah.
They were all shooting for the head. After the shot in the back and the shot in the throat, which incapacitated him, then the kill shots rained down on him. And my first discovery was in 1992 when I discovered a vapor trail, a condensation trail left by a bullet that appears in frame Z-295. It grazed him and went on, and it's the bullet that probably hit Governor Connally in the wrist. The second shot is the 313 kill shot. Now, here's what proves that Oswald is innocent. Z-295 and Z-313 are separated by 18 frames. The film is being shot at 18 frames per second. That's a one-second time delay between two shots. Nobody can shoot that fast without an automatic weapon. And nobody can reload a rifle like Oswald's in less than 2.5 seconds. So if he shot, it would take him click, 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 two bolt actions to load.
Right. In and out and shoot with accuracy.
So, and, oh, my God. People think that it's easy to shoot with a telescopic sight. I tell somebody, you want to find out how easy it is to sight something with a telescopic sight? Grab a roll of toilet paper, the carton in the center, and look through it and try to spot something instantly. Go to the window and say, I'm going to see that car. See how long it takes you to sight that up.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
And it's moving.
And it was moving. And here's the other part. The tree, the oak trees in front of the Texas School Book Depository blocked all the shots from the time that he passed in front of the vestibule, past the sign. He didn't clear the trees from the sixth-floor window vantage point until he was beyond the sign.
Now, you also say that there were some incredibly courageous actions of Jackie Kennedy.
Explain that. Oh, my Lord.
Now, all I saw was her crawling on the trunk of the car.
What you saw was depicted as a panic, terrified woman slapping away the body and jumping on the trunk.
Grabbing piece of the brain matter to try to put it back in his head.
That was the explanation. That was the true story of why she did it. However, here is what has happened. I have discovered the missing frames of the Zapruder film, and they show Jackie's actions. Jackie heard the shots, and she thought they were motorcycle backfire. But then she heard these terrible gurgling sounds coming from John Kennedy, and she turned and she slid across the back seat, and she put her arm around his shoulders at first, and looked into his face like, "Jack, what's wrong with you?" You know, he was choking, the bullet in his throat.
Yeah,
and As the car went on, it arrived at that the kill zone at the grassy knoll, at which point the driver actually hit the brake and the car stopped completely. At that point, a fusillade ensued. There was a shot at 295, which left the vapor trail, grazed him and hit Connolly. But then the kill shot at 313. Now, here's what's taken out. She put her arm around him. The head exploded. She winced, opened her eyes, and saw he was in a dreadful, dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
And she was shocked, and she broke away. She pulled her arm away, put her arm hand up, like a right hand was up in the air.
That's when she went crawling away?
No, there's more to come. Then she saw that he was really hurt, and she took him in two arms and hugged him. She embraced him like boyfriend and girlfriend, like husband and wife, like a lioness protecting her cub. And she looked. She lifted her head, and she looked. And they're like, who's doing this? And she held him after the first two shots until two more shots ripped him to shreds.
Jeez.
And they came.
She's lucky she didn't get hit, too.
This is the point. The first shot came down on him from the right front and bounced up like and went across the street, which is what was called the Harper fragment. The second shot came more from directly from the front, from the picket fence, took out the back of his head where she had her arm around his neck and almost took her arm away with it. But the most incredible thing I see is her reactions. As that bullet tore through the back of his head and she saw the piece fly off, her arm made an incredible reaction as if to grab the piece in the air. Imagine trying to catch the bullet. It's kind of like that. The bullet went through, the piece went after, and she went trying to grab it. And when she saw the piece on the trunk, she very naturally let go of Jack, turned on her right hip, her right knee, her left knee, and crawled out like a cat going after the fragment. At that point, the car was stopped. But when Greer saw the president's head blown off, he hit the pedal to the metal, and the car took off, and she was starting to roll off. But she was so intent on getting that piece of bone fragment that Clint Hill, who was running up, he saw what was happening. He saw what she was after, and he knew that she was going after that. No matter
Did
what.
You see the scene, though, before the shooting, of the Secret Service agent who was running alongside the car, and they basically told him to stand down, and he's throwing his arms up in the air like, what are you people doing?
Yes, he was waved off. And let me tell you this. A lot of people believe that that's a conspiracy, part of the conspiracy. But JFK was part of this conspiracy. And Congressman Henry Gonzalez was there at the airport, and he says that JFK himself said, I don't want those guys standing there. And you know why? Because he knew the plot to kill him was on, and he did not want one of those Secret Service men to take a bullet for him. That's what I believe. And so if you believe Henry Gonzalez, who was present, he says it was JFK who said, take those guys off the runner. And let the people see me. You see? So, which story you believe is up to you. But I heard Henry Gonzalez and read his testimonies on this topic. And I know what kind of a person John F. Kennedy was. He was a survivor of World War II. He'd been through the war, battles, wounds, lost crewmen, dead men on his under his command. And I sincerely do believe that he didn't want a Secret Serviceman to take a bullet for him.
Huh.
And that he went into the lion's den. You see, President Kennedy knew about the assassination plots from days before.
And there were several others.
Right. They were planning to kill him in Miami.
That's right. And also Chicago?
And Chicago.
Yeah.
And there was a planned motorcade in Miami that was supposed to tour from the airport to the Orange Bowl. But it was canceled because the Miami police had tape recorded Joseph Miltier, head of the Ku Klux Klan, discussing President Kennedy's assassination and that of Martin Luther King with William Somerset, an informant, and the information was given to the FBI. and the Secret Service. And for that reason, the planned motorcade was canceled, and he was flown by helicopter from the airport directly into the Orange Bowl, where he had a political triumph. The reason he went to the Orange Bowl was to make peace with the Cuban community. What President Kennedy had done was he had secured the release of all the Bay of Pigs
suspects.
Yeah, the soldiers that had landed and had been wallowing.
Those that probably weren't killed, right?
Those weren't killed, yes, of course. I meant the ones that survived and were in prison.
Sure.
So Kennedy traded food and medicine, antibiotics, with Castro. As a gesture of goodwill, Castro released the men. And that kind of ruffled the feathers of the Cuban community.
Well, give me your conclusion, Robert. What do you think, who do you think was responsible for this?
I can tell you directly who was responsible, because E. Howard Hunt confessed on his deathbed that he was involved, that Lyndon Johnson and Cord Meyer were the big planners, and Cord Meyer had a laundry list of grievances against Kennedy, including his continued dalliances and trice with his wife, Mary Meyer. Then Johnson was on his way to jail that day, November 22nd, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The Senate committee investigating the charges of his corruption was coming down with their decision to impeach him. So if Johnson did not become president by 1 o'clock that afternoon, he was going to see a long term in federal prison for all the corruption that had been exposed in the Billy Sylvester's.
That's right.
Land scam affair and the Bobby Baker bribery affairs and his known connections to the mafia. So it was an act of desperation on the part of Lyndon Johnson and the CIA, because President Kennedy had given notice that he was going to dismantle the CIA. He had notified the Pentagon that he was designating them as his primary source of intelligence, and that they were to be on their own initiative or at his asking, at his request, they were to be the principal providers of intelligence. He also, in June of 1963, he abolished the Operations Planning Board and the Psychological Strategy Board of the CIA. Now, here's the deep irony, deepest irony. The United States government had an assassination apparatus since the 1950s. And this is information that I give to you from the Church Committee findings.
Well, I believe it. They took the president of South Vietnam out.
Right.
Hugh.
Listen to this. This committee was called, ultimately, it was called the 5412 Committee. It was called the October 5th Committee, the October 20th Committee, and then the 5412 Committee. And the 5412 Committee was in charge of eliminating political opposition to the United States. And this is the group that Johnson referred to as, when he said to Walter Cronkite, he says, I can tell you that in the early 1960s, we were running a murder incorporated in the Caribbean. Right? This is what he was talking about. The 5412 Committee was an executive action committee in the sense of execute. Right?
Hold on, Robert. We're at that top already. Wow, this is fast. We'll be back. We'll take calls, too, next on Coast to Coast AM.